From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In.
They believe that what we're being told is everything they need to know, and they just pay attention to that.
You actually have to teach the teachers how to teach for innovation.
With your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford, and I'm here with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, who is the dean of the Graduate School of Education.
Dr. D. Pope, it's always good to be with you.
Always fun to be with you, Dan. And today's show got me thinking of something that I did many, many years ago.
What is today's show?
Today's show is going to be about literature and the teaching of literature. And I am a literature teacher. So I studied, I was an English major in college as an undergrad. And when I went to get my master's degree in education and certification to teach in English, you actually have to take a test at the end in the state. This was in Massachusetts.
To become a teacher.
To become a teacher. And if you are teaching at the high school level, you have to take an additional test in your subject area. Okay, so I had to take an English test. So here I was, an English major. I was taking graduate courses in English, and I had to take something called the CLEP. Okay, it sounds like the clap, right? In fact, I thought it was the clap, and when I went to look it up, it's actually called the CLEP, which is the college
so
level.
Most tests are sort of awful, but having a test called the clap would really turn you off.
Really bad, really bad. So college level examination program. So, you know, there were about five of us who were all English majors at pretty good universities across the country, and we were feeling pretty confident about this test. Like, oh, you know, this is what college students take. We got this, right? So we all take it. We thought it was okay. You know, we didn't know how we did. We got it back, and we barely passed this test. Yes. And we tried to figure out what the heck was going on. And it turns out when you're an English major and you're pretty skilled at that level, you look at these questions like, what is supposed to be the main idea of the story? And you read way too much into it. You see nuance where you're not supposed to see nuance. And on the writing portion, right? So there's a 45-minute essay. We're about to go into the world to teach writing. Like, we really know how to do this. Some barely passed on that because they wanted the very formulaic, have a topic sentence, have three supporting sentences, have a conclusion.
No.
And that's just not how the real world works.
No, I get this. It's the perverse thing of the expert. So I was an undergraduate in philosophy, and I was debating whether to get an advanced degree in philosophy. Ultimately, I decided I didn't want to be a taxi driver, but I had to take a test. And there was this question on Aristotle, and there were four choices, and I knew what they thought was the right choice. But of course, that was not my interpretation of Aristotle.
Right, of course.
And the answer is, don't be stupid. Give the answer they want. That's what
play
a test
the
is.
Play the game. But the problem is, you just want to scream, right? Because you think, this is not what you should be asking me. And I mean, first of all, I think it's so funny that as a philosophy major, they give you a multiple choice test. Like, that just in and of itself, there's something wrong just with that, right? The concept.
So tests are used for a lot of different reasons. You know, so like one of my I teach, I give tests. The reason I give tests aren't really to rank students. It's sort of a motivation for them to work harder. You know, there's a few things like cramming for learning things that you'll forget right away. But I want to give you an example of a test that was given in college. So in my college, they had an honors track. And I had a friend who did the Shakespeare honors track. And they bring in an external examiner to interview you. And so it's an oral test.
Okay.
And one of the questions was, how many times does the word strawberry show up in Shakespeare?
You are kidding me. Come on.
No. And so, so here's the challenge. Why would they ask that question? Is it like they just randomly chose a word or can you guess?
Why would they care? I mean, that's ridiculous. I guess they want you to say, why does that matter? Maybe they want you to fight the question.
What did strawberry stand for in Shakespeare's time? No, I think it was because he wanted to know how much you had read. Like, if you read all of Shakespeare and you said you saw it 1,000 times when it never showed up, then he sort of knows you didn't read.
Okay, but I would never say 1,000 for Shakespeare. I've read a lot of Shakespeare. I'm guessing it happens twice.
Right. So that may not be perfect, but the fact that you're kind of close means you've read it.
Okay.
So that I think that was the point of the test. It wasn't, this is the way you should read. is to memorize how many times a particular word shows up.
Oh, my God. Well, I'm glad that we have our guest here today. Our guest is Dr. Sarah Levine, and she is an assistant professor at the Graduate School of Education, and she studies high school literature, and particularly she has looked at 100 years of standardized testing, the New York State Regents exam. So welcome, Sarah. We are thrilled to have you here.
Thank you.
Welcome. And so did you know that Sarah also started a youth radio program?
No. Oh, my God. You should have experience here.
So let's hear the radio voice.
I never was on the radio.
Oh, my God.
Never mind.
Okay.
Never mind.
That's too funny. So, okay, Sarah, you have looked at a bunch of standardized tests. So, of course, Dan Schwartz has a standardized test for you.
Yes. This has been...
C.
I've close. Okay. So the problem with literature tests is or are, A, they misdiagnose understanding. B, they take too much class time. C, they stress the students out too much. D, they send the wrong message about learning. E, all of the above. F, A, C, and D. G, A, B, and D.
Oh, my God.
H, none of the above.
Okay, you have the right to say that is crazy. I missed half of that. Or can you repeat the questions?
It's clearly all of the above.
All of the above.
Ah. And maybe also G, F, A, and E minus B.
She's good.
It's
Dan.
For sure all of the above. At least for, I'd say, for most or many standardized tests of literary reading in the country today.
So if you had to choose one, the test misdiagnoses understanding, the test is a bad use of time, the test causes too much stress, and the test sends the wrong message to students about what they're supposed to be learning, which of these four would you go after first?
I'd say the final choice, the tests send the wrong message, but it's not just to students, it's to teachers. And even if teachers don't agree with the message that the tests are sending, at this point, they're kind of forced to let the tests drive how they teach. So they kind of have to take that message to their students.
Okay, so wait, let's back up a little bit. But tell us about what you looked at and what you found that led you to this conclusion.
I looked at about 75 standardized tests of literary reading from about 1900 to now. And I looked at a couple of things. I looked at what kinds of questions test makers are asking students to answer. I looked at the kinds of interpretations test makers are interested in having students make. I looked at how much test makers want kids to kind of summarize what they read and how much they want kids to talk about mood or theme or tone, things like that. And then I looked at the kinds of questions, the kinds of essay questions that test makers have asked students over the century to see what kinds of message we're sending to kids and to teachers about what's valuable about literary reading.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So that's what I looked at.
Okay.
Make sure this isn't sort of my ability to read at the level of a sentence. This is my appreciation and ability to glean truths from literature.
It's both.
It's both.
It's both. And if you look, it won't surprise you to know that at the beginning of the century, really up until like the 50s or 60s, the tests were most interested in a couple of things. Number one, can you read something and summarize it? So like you just said, can you literally understand what you just read? Number one. Number two, can you talk about Macbeth off the top of your head, assuming that you've read Macbeth? And number three, if I give you 40 questions about 40 pieces of literature, can you answer 20 of them correctly? So what was the name of the main character in The Scarlet Letter? Was
Strawberry.
Strawberry, blueberry, Hester, right. Or?
Hester. I say Hester. You are listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope, and we are here with Dr. Sarah Levine talking about the teaching of literature, but particularly standardized tests for assessing knowledge of literature. So this is a problem. This is a problem when they ask those things, when you've seen this over time. Why do you say it's sending the wrong messages?
So we don't ask those questions anymore. We don't ask what's the name of the protagonist of The Scarlet Letter.
Wait, who's we? I know some teachers who do.
Standardized tests of literary reading no longer ask those kinds of recall questions. You won't find an English test across the country that asks that kind of question anymore.
Interesting.
You'll find questions now on, number one, interpretation. That's multiple choice interpretation. So does the tone of this poem, can it best be described as bitter, resentful, resigned, or delighted?
Okay, see, this was the problem on the CLEP test for me, because I could read that poem and I could really see bitter and resigned kind of similarly. That's a tough question.
Yeah. And I think the conclusion we can draw from those kinds of questions is that they basically are hostile to literary reading. You cannot use multiple choice questions to ask kids to develop, build, construct, or articulate interpretations. You just can't.
Wow, that's a pretty powerful statement. Sorry. So you've just thrown out all of those tests that do that and you're saying that's not good.
But wait a minute. So I go to a movie. People say, what'd you think of the movie? And I'd say, well, it's kind of dark and bitter.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I've done a pretty good job of summarizing it.
But was it more dark or more bitter? That's kind of the problem that she's talking about.
Why do I care about that level of subtlety?
Because the test is asking.
Is it? It was not resentful.
The right. test
it wasn't
to
happy.
Know.
It wasn't happy. We know that.
Right. We got rid of D.
Yay, Dan. We got rid of D. We have three left.
We got 33%.
Yeah. Woo.
And this is why teachers end up having to teach, you know, teachers who love their kids and who love their subject end up having to teach kids about process of elimination, getting rid of the silly answer. And then now your job, instead of stepping into the world of the text to see what kinds of ideas and feelings you can kind of construct from that text, you have to step into the world of the test makers' minds to see what they think you will think the right answer is.
It's called critical thinking.
Yeah. The question is, whose worlds do we want to be thinking about? Do we want to be thinking about Toni Morrison's world, or do we want to be thinking about the test makers' idea of Toni Morrison, which is going to be the most kind of lowest common denominator, most kind of common response to Toni Morrison?
So I need to back up a little bit. When I think about assessing, mm-hmm. right, I need to be very precise in what I'm after. And so, people are talking about thinking like a historian.
Right, right.
Or thinking like a mathematician.
Right.
So I think this is one of the big revolutions in teacher education. It's become discipline-based.
That's
it's
right.
not enough to be a good teacher. It's English depends on something different than history. So what does it mean to think like an Englishtarian?
Exactly. What
is that?
Is that
a word? I don't think that's a word.
Englishtarian?
Englishtarian.
Okay.
Yeah, English teachers talk about this. There's thinking like a historian, there's thinking like a scientist, and there's thinking like a...
Literarian.
Right.
Oh, okay. That sounds better.
You like that one
that
better,
sounds yeah. better. You're listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope, and we are here with Sarah Levine talking about literarians, mm-hmm. people who teach literature, and how we assess the knowledge of our students.
But we want to get a fix on what it means to sort of approach literature in a satisfying, effective way.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of part of what's been interesting about looking at all these standardized tests over the century. In the 20s and the 50s and the 70s, thinking like an Englishist or a literarianist meant thinking about how a piece of literature might affect your view of the world or your sympathy towards people you might not ordinarily have sympathy for or your understanding of why people change or what their motivations are. So they are interested in you thinking about either the world of a text and the characters inside a text or the genre. You know, what does poetry do that that prose doesn't do? How does speaking about this in a poetic form feel different than when it's in a prose form? That's not now. Now, thinking like an Englishist means more or less thinking like a literary critic. So disciplinary thinking in the Common Core era, which is the era we're in now, means considering how a text is built. So talk about how a motif of red helps develop the central idea of this text. Or choose a literary device, setting, or symbol, and talk about how it enhances the passage.
Okay, this sounds horrible. I mean, this is going to turn kids off to reading, no? I mean, this is the problem. This is why people say, oh my God, I hated my English class because I had to think about the color red in, you know, The Great Gatsby.
You channeled that mood.
Why there are like 55 different Facebook groups called My English Teacher Thinks More About the Text Than the Author Did, or I Hate English, or I Used to Love Reading, But Now.
She killed it for me.
Yeah.
So it's funny, you know, I was talking to an English professor about the difference between teaching undergraduate and graduate English. He said at the undergraduate level, the goal is to make them love it. Mm-hmm. At the graduate level, the goal is to make them hate it.
Mm-hmm. See, that is just not – as an English major and as a former high school English teacher, that is not okay. I'm mad. Sarah has made me mad today.
Well, English teachers are mad.
So what would you recommend? I mean, let's talk about the effect on kids. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we got a bunch of these tests now. Mm-hmm. What have you seen happening to how kids respond to literature?
The studies that I've been looking at are more general. And they are about how much kids read, how much kids like reading. And you can see it's pretty clear that kids like reading in elementary school, and that affection for text kind of tops off around, you know, sixth grade or so, and then it just kind of heads downhill until they graduate. Changes in those trends in the research that I've looked at, and we don't know the degree to which standardized literary tests are affecting that disaffection.
Well, and I can say as a mom, what I see with my own kids is this real love of reading, and you read for pleasure, and then you get to middle school and high school, and there's literally no time to read for pleasure, even if they wanted to, and you have to read the books that are in the class. So, you know, this even though my kids really love reading, because of a whole bunch of other things getting in the way, not just the tests, they can't do what they love just from a, you know, practical standpoint, that there's no time.
Yeah. English teachers are really in a bind right now. And I've been looking at kind of several extremes, or maybe I'll just say two extremes of in terms of teaching literature. And one is, you know what? Screw it. Let's get our kids to enjoy reading the way we enjoy reading, like social readers, like citizen readers. So
book clubs.
Exactly. So let's get a library of texts in here. Let's have the kids choose what they want to read. And let's spend time in class just reading. And then on the other extreme, we have to think about how to teach kids to think clinically, kind of in a sterile way, about how this text is built, and never mind the reader.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We will have more with Sarah Levine talking about a better way to teach literature and a better way to assess literature next on SiriusXM Insight 121. We translate the research we know about best practices with school, curriculum, and parenting to teachers, administrators, parents, and youth.
You're listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope from the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are here with Dr. Sarah Levine talking about the teaching of literature and how to assess what students really know and understand and how to make them not hate it in the process.
So I still don't have a good fix on this. And it turns out I was an English teacher for a while.
What?
It turns
out. Come on.
Yeah, I was when I first started.
A philosophy major teaching English.
Oh, if you know philosophy, you know everything.
You know everything.
Skip the discipline-based specialization. No, I took a lot of English courses in college. And I'm not sure I ever got it, what it was I was supposed to be doing with this literature. Like my dad, he could cite poems. He could just from memory, and I just thought that was awesome. So Shakespeare, I memorized some stuff.
Okay, give us a line, Dan. Come on, show off.
What passion hangs these weights upon my tongue?
That's good.
She hangs in the cheek of night like a jewel in Ethiop's ear. Isn't that good?
I'm impressed.
What else do I need?
I am duly impressed. But I will tell you that I had to memorize stuff in high school, and yeah. I had to memorize in Old English, Chaucer, Canterbury Tales, Juan that opera with the Shure Sota, the Drucht of March had Perisset to the Rota. Wow. I mean, we're talking.
We need a show on Latin.
This was horrible. I hated it.
Okay, so my quotes came from Romeo and Juliet. And I'm suspecting that the way I processed that text was inappropriate. So I want you to ask us a question to find out if Denise and I got the content, the literary content of Romeo and Juliet. So you ask us the question, and Denise goes first.
Oh, yeah.
And then I just get to make a joke about Denise's answer, whatever it is.
This is sort of the modus operandi for every show, just right, in case you didn't know, Sarah. Right. Okay. All right, I'm ready.
I want to know why I want to know if you got the content of Romeo and Juliet.
You're our high school English teacher.
Mm-hmm.
We've read Romeo and Juliet.
Mm-hmm.
What do you want us to know? How would you assess our knowledge?
Or reaction or whatever it is, because mm-hmm. this is the part I'm fuzzy on. Mm-hmm. I don't quite know what I'm supposed to be doing as the reader.
Yeah, and I really think – I hate to say it's so complex, but I think it's really complex. And there's a reason that English teachers themselves haven't quite figured out what they think literature should do for kids. But I will play along, and I will ask you a couple of different questions. First of all,
I'm so scared. I'm so scared right now.
I wish people could see the pain in Sarah's face.
Sarah is pained because we're making her do something she doesn't want to do. And Denise is pained because she's going to now make a fool out of herself. Okay, go ahead, Sarah.
It would, of course, depend on what kind of reader you were.
I'm a great reader.
And how old you were?
I'm 16.
And how much you had read before?
I love reading. I read all the time.
Okay. So I might... can I ask you a bunch of questions, or can I only ask one to figure out?
Ask her one and ask me a different one.
Ask him a harder one.
All right. So one question I might ask that might help me get at your understanding not just of the content of Romeo and Juliet, which I think is worth knowing because to follow the story.
Yeah, you can't talk about.
Of course.
If you don't know the content, you can't really have a discussion
about
the book.
Right. To follow the story, number one, is fun. And number two, allows you for all sorts of other richer understandings.
Right.
But there's other things to think about, like what about the language? How much do they understand the connections between the language and the effects of this play on a reader or on a viewer? So I might ask something like, Romeo and Juliet is one of the most taught texts in high school. And it's taught because it's supposed to help us understand the complexity of love and of family, and it's supposed to help us understand the beauty of language. Do you think we should teach it next year? And does it do all of these things? Or maybe it doesn't. What do you think?
See,
and
I like
why?
That. I like that, Dan. You know why I like that question? Because I would say, yes, we should teach it because in high school is all about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And Romeo and Juliet is about sex, drugs, and rock and roll and love and passion and your parents telling you can't do something and you're fighting back and finding independence. And when you have true love, that's all that matters. And I think it's important.
Don't they all die? Isn't that how it is?
Yeah, but that – okay, no, first of all, spoiler alert. But no, I would say – so yes, I would say that would be my answer. And while Dan is thinking of his, this is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope, and we're talking with Sarah Levine, and she's about to stump Dan Schwartz by asking him a question about Romeo and Juliet, the point of which is to show that it's really hard to assess student understanding of literature.
So, but the thing I liked about that question was that it was really getting at your reaction, your personal. How did this personally affect you, and do you care enough for other people to be affected similarly?
And I had to know the plot. I had to understand enough to answer the question. I was given a place to state an opinion. She cares what I think about what she teaches next year.
Mm-hmm.
That's
so
awesome.
So the answer to the question isn't right or wrong. It's the content that matters.
Importantly, also, it is accountable to the text. I'm not just asking you, do you like love?
Right.
Romeo and Juliet was about love. How do you feel about
love? I love love.
Right. So it's accountable to the text. It's interested in your interaction or engagement with the text. And it also places Romeo and Juliet, 500 years old, in the context of current debates and discussions.
Right. So you could also ask a question like, have you ever been in a situation like Romeo and Juliet?
You could. Now, that would lead to a different kind of thinking. I could think about the fact that they were in love and they really loved each other, even though they were only 13. And right. maybe it was really lust. And then I would think about my own life and I could stop thinking about Romeo and Juliet if I wanted to.
Right. And just write a whole bunch on that and get. And so that's a way, if you didn't read the book, you could really game that question. So that's not good.
Obviously, it depends on what your goals are. Maybe so, you want to use this play as a jumping off point to talk about different worldviews about what love should be.
So I think I'm going to channel my 16-year-old.
Okay.
Which would be, no, I think I'd rather watch the movie by Leonardo DiCaprio.
Mm-hmm. He's a great director.
And get the same experience and not have to read all those words that were just too far away from me. And well, we went too fast, by the way.
A lot of kids read, watch the movie instead of reading the book or read the Spark Notes. So would you have a question for Dan that would allow him to not, like, get him in trouble for watching the movie?
I would love to know your argument for maybe skipping reading the play and going straight to watching the movie. Now that you've done both, what do we lose, if anything, by getting rid of the book? And why is it okay just to watch the movie? What do we gain? And please help me understand by pointing to particular places in the book and in the movie that you think kind of help prove your point.
Haha, you have to point in the book.
Yeah, that's like 40 years ago. Not going to happen.
but this is
a broader question, which is, you know, we started putting a lot of instruction online as videos. Mm-hmm. And people want the videos instead of reading the text, which is much clearer and better. And I don't quite get it. I understand why I would do it for Romeo and Juliet, is that my power of imagination can't fill in the historical context. Mm-hmm. And so it was too hard for me to understand.
Mm-hmm. So we have learned a lot today, Sarah. Thank you so much, because we now know standardized tests are not really the way to capture necessarily what we want to capture from the teaching of literature.
But we also learned from you, if the child is going to be taking a test in class, don't tell the child, no, just give the wrong answer because you know better.
Right. Don't do that. And we also know that it's really important to think about why you're doing the teaching of this. What is it you want them to get out of it? So thank you, Sarah. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We're on the campus of Stanford University and on Sirius XM Insight 121.
Zero strawberries.
From the campus of Stanford University, this has been Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.